Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Welcome
Hello,
to the
and
New
welcome
Books
back
Network.
To New Books in Political Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Lamisa Abdelati from the Maxwell School of Syracuse University. Today, I'll be talking to Ian Sanjay Patel about his book, We're Here Because You Were There, Immigration and the End of Empire, which was published by Verso in 2021. Ian, welcome to the show.
Hi, Lamisa. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
So I wonder if you could begin the interview by just telling us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, I'm currently assistant professor at Birkbeck College, University of London. And my work explores connections between human rights, global history, political thought. And I tend to work historically.
Wonderful. And that really comes across in this book. So let's jump in. How did you come to write this book, We're Here Because You Were There?
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, I began my career thinking about human rights, contemporary human rights. But after a while, I became more and more interested in the historical formations of human rights. And then, a few years ago, I started thinking about an episode, a historical episode, which seemed to bring together the professional and the personal. So I'd always known that in my own family background, there was a piece of legislation that made it very hard for my family to migrate to the British Isles, where I was eventually born. I was born in London. So I'd always known about that, and I'd always known that it was a sort of strange episode in the sense that I'd been told growing up that that my father and my grandparents and the community had full British citizenship. So I'd always sort of known about this. And then at a certain point, I started to read more and more, you know, as you do, given that it was so relevant to my history. And then the more I dug into it, the more of a remarkable episode it seemed to be, in the sense that you have a group, quite a large group, over 100,000 a group of British citizens who have an identical citizenship to the British Prime Minister at the time, and this is in the late 1960s. This group of people are ancestrally Indian, but they're resident in East Africa. And for a set of reasons, they try to migrate to Britain, and they're unable to, because there's this piece of legislation which is deliberately designed just for them to stop them coming. So how is that? So I started thinking to myself, you know, how is that possible? How can somebody with citizenship identical to the citizenship held by British people born in British cities like Leeds and London, how can they not have the right, the unrestricted right, to enter their legal homeland, if you like? Their ancestral homeland is, of course, India, South Asia, but their legal homeland is Britain. And there came a sort of tipping point where I thought, you know, I really need to, I should write about this, an entire book about this, as it turned out. And there was some literature out there on the episode, and I'd been consuming it over the years as a, you know, just for my own interest. But I think the tipping point was really getting to grips with the legal side. So this is really the British nationality law and the fact that Britain had passed legislation targeting its own citizens. So this is really irregular and quite bizarre that you have British policymakers in the 1960s passing immigration laws targeting their own citizens, their own nationality law, which is highly irregular and unusual, as it turns out. And really, you know, I'm not even sure the legislation should have even been called immigration legislation. So it got to that point, and I thought that, okay, I'm going to write about this. And then in order to make sense of this bizarre legal situation and all the intricacies of, you know, how it was possible that these citizens could not be given entry to the place that they're attached to, I had to sort of tell a much bigger political story about it. And, you know, and that was the beginning of the book.
So let's dive in and begin with the title, right? We're here because you were there. Now, in the book, this sentence is almost an organizational framework. It structures the book. Can I ask you to tell us more about this sentence and how it informs the book's approach?
Sure. Well, you know, as everybody knows, when you're writing a book, titles are important. And it's a memorable aphorism or phrase, we're here because you were there. And, you know, I thought about other titles, but this is the title that really dramatizes what's at stake. You know, why are these migrants coming to the British Isles? The only way of making sense of why they are, why they have the citizenship in the first place is to think about the British Empire, which, as it turns out, is very relevant here, even though it's a story in the 1960s. So the phrase "we're here because you were there" comes from a Sri Lankan writer and activist called A. Sivanandam, and he was quite active during the 1960s, 70s, and 80s. And this was a sort of a campaign, really an activist slogan, and it was picked up and sort of used in a variety of circumstances, and I think that it sort of really helps us zone in on this particular type of immigration, where it's immigration based on the history of empire.
Absolutely. So early on in the book, you provide a discussion of British immigration that emphasizes its global dimensions. And this sort of sets the stage for the subsequent chapters. Can I ask you to tell us about that?
Yeah, well, you know, normally when you read about British post-war migration or the history of British immigration, it tends to be told as a domestic story. So it tends to be told as a 20th century story that begins with Jewish migrants who are traveling westwards from the Russian Empire. But actually, the way that both many migrants themselves, as well as the British policymakers and elites who were trying to make sense of post-war migration in the 50s and 60s, the way they actually, their vision of what migration was in the British context was actually had a different set of roots, which are far beyond the shores of the British Isles. So an interesting thing about the British Empire, which again is sort of easy to forget, is that it was an empire of two halves. There were colonies that didn't have many British people traveling from the British Isles and settling there. And then there were others that did. And they became, over the years, seen as white Anglo-Saxon settler colonies. So the what we're talking about here is the difference between Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, which are all these countries, their origins are in British people getting on ships and traveling there to settle. They are different from places like Jamaica and Kenya and India to an extent. And what happens is that when these British people who've left Britain and traveled to Canada, New Zealand, Canada and Australia, what happens is when their settler colonialism starts to take root is they don't want non-white people coming in. So the very first immigration laws in the British context are actually not in the British Isles. They're in places like Canada and Australia, New Zealand and South Africa. And that's actually where you have the origins of the British, the Imperial British, trying to keep out non-white people. In this case, Asians. So Asiatic at that time, you know, we're talking here the late 19th century, turn of the 20th century, that was a term referring to Japanese, Indians, and Chinese. And these were the groups that the first immigration laws targeted. So when Britain, if you fast forward to the first immigration laws that post-war Britain passes, they remember these original laws that were passed at the beginning of the 20th century. So I thought it was really important to kind of to show these connections, because it's important in all sorts of ways for the law, but also thinking about how post-war Britain, the British Isles, how they saw themselves, because really they never had to deal with non-white people migrating in large numbers until after 1945. So they thought of immigration, non-white immigration, as a problem that the Canadians and the Australians and South Africans, that was their problem, and they passed a lot of very discriminatory laws, and the policymakers in London tried to keep them sort of as not explicitly racist. And then all of a sudden, by the 1960s, the British are passing, they're the ones passing the sort of quite obviously racially discriminatory laws.
Fascinating. After you sort of, you know, set the stage, you tell the story of Britain's post-war immigration and citizenship, and you break that down into two phases, 1945 to 1962, and then 1962 to 1981. So let's maybe start with the 1948 British Nationality Act. How does that figure into your analysis?
Yeah, so this is kind of the sort of the crunch moment, really, about the whole book in a way. And, you know, what this really comes down to is remembering that the end of empire was a process, not an event. And it happens over time. And that is so important to remember. And unfortunately, when we look back at these periods of history, we tend to think quite simplistically. So we think, okay, well, empire ended and then nation states began. You know, so it's these sort of neat boxes, but it really wasn't like that at all. And there was actually a whole period where the boundary between empire and nation state was very, very fluid. And it's easy to forget that, you know, even, you know, for most of the 20th century, so the first 60 years of the 20th century, the nation state was only one kind of political unit. There was federation, there was world government, world states, all sorts of different ways of conceptualizing a place politically. And this also applies to citizenship. So it's not as if you can, and this is particularly the case for the former European empires, it's not just the case that one day imperial citizenship ended and national citizenship began. And that's particularly the case with Britain. And this is where things get really odd about the British Empire, because, you know, when did the British Empire end? You know, an obvious date would be 1947, when India becomes independent. Now, when India becomes independent, the British Empire, in terms of great power, is pretty much over. The British can no longer marshal huge amounts of people, huge resources, and they can't make use of India in the way that they had done in the Second World War, for example. So British great power and the empire itself is pretty much over in 1947. But of course, the African colonies and the colonies in the Caribbean, and in places like Malaya, which became Malaysia in Southeast Asia, these remain. The British Empire actually remains until the 1960s. It's really in the 1960s, not the 1940s, when the British Empire ends. And this is so crucial to understand, because, you know, when you think about that date, 1948, so we're talking about the British Nationality Act, 1948. This is one of the only one of three times in the 20th century when the British sat down to create new statutory law on their nationality and their citizenship. So it's a big moment, and it's 1948. So we're post-war. Britain is reeling and very broken from the Second World War, diminished. India's just got independence. Canada and Australia are more assertive in their national identity than they've ever been before. You know, they're still tied to the British Empire constitutionally, but they're clearly nation states in their own right. They accede to, they join the United Nations separately from a British bloc. So you think, well, hang on, this is the perfect opportunity for the British to nationalize their citizenship, to not make their citizenship imperial any longer, because, you know, it's the post-war world. There's clearly there's change. But the thing is, the closer that you get to that period of history, you realize it was still an imperial age to some extent, you know, particularly in terms of what the British were able to do with the support of the United States for a period, particularly as the Cold War kicks in. The United States was prepared to tolerate the British Empire for quite a few years. So what happens in this piece of legislation then in 1948 is that the British double down on imperial citizenship. They create a new category of imperial citizenship, and they give a huge number of colonies full-blown British citizenship, which means that anybody born in places like Kenya or Jamaica are British citizens still in the late 1940s and onwards. And they even start giving out citizenship rights to other places like India, that's in the process of creating its own national citizenship. India is also has rights of entry and residence in Britain, not as British citizens, but as something called Commonwealth citizens, which is where the legal side gets quite complex. But the main thing to remember is that what Britain's trying to do is to say the empire remains unified. That's really what so it's about continuity, not change. So, okay, India's got independence, Canada and Australia are going their own way. Clearly there's a commitment under the UN Charter to wind up these colonies, and that, you know, there's no Britain's no longer annexing territories. That's long gone. It's really the countdown to decolonization. But instead, Britain starts giving out imperial citizenship and saying, actually, we're unified, and that there's actually this constitutional thread at the level of nationality, which still connects India, Australia, Jamaica, Kenya. And this is very useful for the British. And they thought that it was an easy, I still think about this, what was the rationale? I mean, what the most obvious thing to bear in mind here is that the British had no concept of what was going to happen. So let's just pause then and think about this again. It's 1948. They've just passed the British Nationality Act. They've sustained imperial citizenship. They've given rights of entry and residence to hundreds of millions of people, most of them non-white people, all around the world. They have no concept that these non-white people are going to exercise their right to enter the imperial motherland, or that Indians and Pakistanis would start traveling to the former colonial metropole. Now, they probably, a lot of this was about keeping the family Anglo-Saxon ties alive. So they obviously want people in Australia and New Zealand and Canada to be able to travel back to sea, back to their ancestral homelands in the British Isles without any nationality issues. But the key point here is that the late 1940s, it was still very expensive to travel by ship to get on a ship and travel from Jamaica to London. This was a quite prohibitively expensive thing to do. So we're before the age of mass mobility. The British had no idea what was going to happen next, which is, of course, people in the Caribbean, particularly African Caribbean people in the Caribbean, and Indians and Pakistanis would start actually exercising their legal right of entry in relatively large numbers. I mean, not numbers that we would think of as large today, but tens of thousands. They start to exercise that right in the 1950s, and that's the game changer. And Britain is left with this piece of legislation that it's passed. And the British Nationality Act 1948, as I said, they only passed statutory law on nationality three times in the 20th century. So this is a huge piece of legislation. You can't just sort of dismantle it easily. There's all sorts of constitutional, political issues that might come. And, it's basically like saying we define ourselves in identitarian terms this way for the post-war world. But, there's some Jamaicans and Indians and Pakistanis coming, so we're going to actually dismantle this huge piece of legislation. No, they were stuck with it. And at a certain point, as I'll talk about later, there were other reasons why they ended up keeping it.
So let's get into that. So how does, if you describe these incredible unanticipated consequences, right, of this 1948 British Nationality Act. So how does that unfold then in later years and decades, and how does that inform subsequent legislation?
Right. So in the 1950s, non-white people start arriving to the British Isles, and they're full citizens. They're either they're either born in colonies, so they have this identical citizenship to somebody born in Manchester, or they're Commonwealth citizens from places like Australia, but those would be Anglo-Saxon, most likely, but also India and Pakistan. And they also have rights of entry and residence. And very quickly, British policymakers in the 1950s start panicking. And they use, for the first time, a phrase which would later saturate government correspondence. And that phrase is coloured immigration. So coloured immigration obviously was a racial denominator. In practice, it meant people of African, Caribbean, or South Asian descent largely, but it could also mean people from Southeast Asia, for example. And they start thinking, you know, what are we going to do? We've sustained imperial citizenship. They're coming here legally. The only option the British have is to recreate what the white settler colonies did, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, about half a century before. And they're reluctant to do this because the British saw or have always seen their imperialism as liberal. You know, more British liberal imperialism was not the same as French imperialism, which the British looked down on in terms of its of how liberal and progressive it was. So the sort of reputational cost of passing what would be pretty obvious racially discriminatory legislation against their own citizens was not something that they did lightly. So the British cabinet met no less than 9 times during the 1950s, and they're sort of umming and ahhing, you know, and they came to a sort of stopgap solution, which was that they reached out to the governments of India, West African governments, Caribbean governments, who still have a sort of surprisingly, you know, close ties to the British Isles, you know, either as full-blown colonies or as former colonies, and say, look, we're not happy about people coming here. They're coming. They have the legal right, but we don't want them here. And the Indian government and some, particularly the Indian government, actually, but also other governments in West Africa and the Caribbean oblige and start not giving out passports as readily. Because think about it, you could have a citizenship, but you can't travel. Let's say you're a British citizen and you're living in Jamaica, or you're a Commonwealth citizen with the right of entry into Britain and you're living in India. In order to travel there, you need to have a passport. And so the Indian government, among others, start putting quite punitive educational and financial requirements on giving out passports. So the British think, okay, we've got some kind of solution here. Maybe we don't have to pass legislation to stop non-white people migrating to the UK. But it doesn't work. It doesn't work for a variety of reasons. And then suddenly, you know, by the turn of the 1960s, the British decide to do the unthinkable, and they passed the 1962 Commonwealth Immigrants Act, which is an incredible piece of legislation because it ends in one fell swoop this centuries-old idea of, that you are a British subject, and whoever you are, you could be born in the colonies, you have the right to enter the imperial motherland, and so on. And this ended. And it's legally a complex but pernicious piece of legislation, and it used this particular kind of legal finessing to not be explicitly racially discriminatory in letter, but quite obviously racially discriminatory in practice. And you know, we have declassified correspondence from the Home Secretary saying, you know, this is going to work against what he called colored people exclusively. So this was a sort of watershed moment for Britain, and it was done in 1962, particularly to target African Caribbean people coming from places like Jamaica and Barbados. Then later in the 1960s, in 1968, they passed another piece of law, which was targeting the group that I began talking about. So people of Indian ethnicity and descent who are resident in East Africa. And there's a story behind that. But the sort of three things here are that they're ancestrally South Asian, legally British, resident in East Africa. And for, again, a complex set of reasons, they are this group, which included my father and grandparents, are trying to migrate to the British Isles. And so Britain passes an incredible piece of legislation called the Commonwealth Immigrants Act 1968, which really shouldn't be called, it really shouldn't be called immigration law, because, you know, intuitively immigration law relates to aliens, but this is a kind of non-white British Citizens Act. And through, again, quite sort of pernicious and complex legal finessing, stops their right of entry. Yeah, this is the age of Enoch Powell, who some of you may have heard of, some of your listeners, who was this very, you know, the most famous of the anti non-white immigration campaigners. And a few years later, in 1971, the British completely overhaul their nationality. But they don't pass new British nationality law, they just pass another immigration law, which is called the 1971 Immigration Act. And this is very, I wonder how this will sound. What they did is they said, people still can be British citizens wherever they may be. And remember that the British are sort of hoping that, you know, people are going to take up post-colonial citizenship, and they wouldn't sort of keep their British citizenship, this imperial British citizenship. But you can keep that nominally, but it can only be sort of meaningful, and you can only gain the right of entry into Britain. So anybody trying to enter Britain as a British citizen, needs to show an ancestral connection to the territories of the British Isles. So this is a kind of racial encoding of British nationality, or more precisely, the right of entry into Britain, by saying you need to show that your parent or your grandparent was born in territories of the British Isles themselves. Then you can enter, which is essentially a way of keeping white people unrestricted and making sure that non-white people won't be able to enter. Now, just this is so bizarre, because think about it. The only reason those people, so these people of Indian origin, resident in East Africa, but British by citizenship, the only reason they have imperial British citizenship is because many of them were born in Kenya when it was still a colony. So they gained the citizenship through the territory of the colony, but now they can't actually make the citizenship meaningful by traveling to their legal homeland unless their parent or grandparent has a connection to the territories of the British Isles themselves. And you know, what's so bizarre is that the underlying nationality of Britain remains imperial throughout the 1940s, 50s, 60s and 70s. It's only in 1981 that finally, after, you know, some really astonishing episodes, that the British finally say, okay, let's create a national citizenship. And for the very first time in 1981, the British created the current legal term, British citizen, which is totally built around the territories of the British Isles. It has no reference to, obviously there are very little remaining of Britain's imperial presence overseas. So, you know, coming back to this question we asked earlier, when did the British Empire end? Well, who knows? Was it maybe 1947 when India got independence? Was it 1960 when Harold Macmillan talked about the wind of change blowing through Africa and the inevitability of African decolonization? Or was it actually in 1981, which is very, very recent, a year after Zimbabwe's independence, that Britain finally decolonized?
This episode is brought to you by La Quinta by Wyndham. Your work can take you all over the place, like Texas. You've never been, but it's going to be great because you're staying at La Quinta by Wyndham. Their free bright side breakfast will give you energy for the day ahead. And after, you can unwind using their free high-speed Wi-Fi. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book your stay today at LQ.com.
Remarkable. So let's switch gears a little bit and talk about something that's that you've already mentioned several times, which is the Commonwealth. So in the book, you argue that British elites were seeking to sustain the empire even as imperial power was being taken away, and that's where the Commonwealth comes in. So can you tell us about that process?
Yeah, I mean, this really kind of I came to this, I wanted to know more about this because the Commonwealth is connected to imperial citizenship. So the two things go hand in hand. And imperial citizenship and Commonwealth citizenship, it caused the British so many problems, you know, and we haven't mentioned yet, but the British ended up being ruled racially discriminatory by the European Court of Human Rights in 1973 for these laws, these immigration laws. Why did Britain go through all this reputational cost? You know, being criticized for being racially discriminatory so often. And it's a complex question, but I think that we have tended to underestimate how tenacious British imperialism was in the through the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. There was something to be gained for the British to see themselves not simply as a nation state, but as an imperial Commonwealth. Now, that word Commonwealth might be unfamiliar. That's just a synonym for the British Empire. They've been using it since the 1920s, actually. The British Commonwealth was synonymous with the British Empire. And the Commonwealth still exists today. You know, you may have seen King Charles being ushered in. There were all sorts of references to the Commonwealth. So Britain, there's still a lot of confusion. Is Britain the nation state? Is Britain a Commonwealth? What is the Commonwealth? Now, the normal sort of vision of the Commonwealth is that it's a post-colonial entity, but that's not quite right, particularly at the level of citizenship, which is what's relevant here. So you have this sort of bizarre state of affairs where, you know, as I say, after World War II, empire is really under tremendous pressure. It's not simply the burgeoning norms in the UN and the UN Charter and the way that southern states sort of pivoted the UN towards decolonization, but also the United States, which is the leading global power after 1945, it's only going to tolerate empires when it suits Cold War imperatives. So, of course, the United States didn't allow the Netherlands to reestablish their imperial rule in Indonesia, but the American U.S. officials did allow the British Empire to sort of live on, and the British policymakers, they spun out the Commonwealth. But it really has no sort of real substantive power. So I mentioned earlier that real British great power, that's pretty much over when India gets independence. So really they're left sort of clinging at influence, and also they're left with their imperial constitution. So I guess what I'm getting at here is that the reason that the British allowed imperial citizenship to just roll on and all the way until 1981, and in the meantime sort of bandage up non-white immigration with these laws to keep non-white people out, is because they couldn't let go of this imperial identity. And, you know, if somebody pointed at them and said, well, what is, you know, what makes your empire meaningful? Well, by the 1960s, there's increasingly little that makes it meaningful. There was an imperial political economy built around the sterling currency block, and, you know, sort of imperial trade and trade with former colonies. That's pretty much, you know, that starts to go into abeyance by the late 1950s. So the British are sort of left by saying, well, we're constitutionally imperial. And if they were to dismantle imperial citizenship, you know, it would cause issues. Not only would, you know, there are millions of non-white citizens and nationals who were born overseas. They might try to beat the ban and rush to Britain. There's going to be political fallout, diplomatic fallout. But there's also going to be people looking at Britain and these British elites and saying, well, the empire really must be over, because your citizenship is now national. And the British were just simply not prepared to do that. Paradoxically, even as they joined Europe, which was all about, you know, turning away from empire and turning more towards Europe, particularly at the level of trade, at the level of the constitution and nationality, the British refused to let go.
Okay, now it seems from your book that at the same time, Britain is also operating in a new diplomatic reality, as it were. So I wanted you, if you don't mind, to talk a little bit about the role of the United Nations and also the importance of race in this era.
Yes, I mean, a big theme of the book is the fact that Britain legally was able to pass these racially discriminatory immigration laws, but not without reputational cost. Some of this was bilateral diplomatic criticism. Some of it was sort of hidden from view. Some of it was public. But a huge venue for criticism against British policy on all sorts of things, so on immigration, but also on the British stance to their empire more generally. You know, would the British sell arms to apartheid South Africa? This was all being thrashed out at the United Nations, which went through a transformation in these decades, 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, and also ironically in the fora of the Commonwealth itself. So the Commonwealth is this sort of vehicle that the British are using to absorb all the real and imagined sources of British power. But in reality, it was a venue where post-colonial governments were very, very vocal about criticizing Britain. And this was sort of salt in the wound for British policymakers who were, you know, trying to keep up with a changing world. And really, there is a huge shift in global values, not in the 1940s and in the 1950s, but in the 1960s. The 1960s really is a key decade for all sorts of reasons, for human rights, for decolonization, for the crystallization of the norm against racial discrimination. All of this is happening in the 1960s. There are national stories, but there's also an international story in the UN is quite key. It's important to remember that the UN, the United Nations, is an outcome of World War II, obviously, but it began as an imperial edifice. You know, we tend to think of the UN now, in our sort of popular understanding of it, as the obvious venue for all the states of the world to have their say. But it really wasn't like this. It was an organization that was created by great powers. It was seen to serve the interests of great powers, particularly the United States. And it was also seen to be friendly enough to empire. You know, if you go to the UN Charter and sort of dig into the language, it's interesting because it's sort of half anti-colonial, but also clearly it allows for colonialism to persist. And, you know, Winston Churchill was very vocal on this, that the UN shouldn't impact the British Empire. But then there's a remarkable transformation, and states in the global south, and particularly India, among others, they really take a role, and they use the General Assembly as a kind of international public sphere to really pivot the UN towards anti-colonial ends. And then the 1960s is really this age of sort of crystallizing the norm against racial discrimination. And this happens at the UN. There's actually the very first human rights treaty ever, binding treaty, is passed in 1965, which is the UN Convention banning racial discrimination. Really interesting. And this sort of comes on the back of huge world transnational criticism of apartheid South Africa. And we really see here the customary international law and all sorts of transnational networks closing in on racial discrimination, which makes the British policy so at odds with a changing world. So the British are passing these pretty obviously racially discriminatory immigration laws at the high watermark of anti-racism and anti-colonialism internationally, which creates this huge sort of cauldron of criticism and self-reckoning for them.
Fascinating. So the final part of the book gives a very rich discussion of two particular episodes, the Kenyan South Asian immigration crisis of 1968, and then the Ugandan South Asian immigration crisis of 1972. I'm going to ask if you could briefly give us just a glimpse of some of your analysis there in these two cases.
Yeah, so this is about that group that we began talking about. Indians by origin, resident in East Africa, but British by nationality. And in the late 1960s, there's a set of policies passed by East African governments. In Kenya, these are sort of majoritarian policies targeting Indians, but the letter of the policies are actually against non-citizens. So you remember that these Indians are not actually Kenyan citizens, they're British citizens. And the Kenyan government had made it quite hard, relatively hard, for these Indians to acquire national Kenyan citizenship. So en masse, these Indians in Kenya and then later in Uganda, because of Idi Amin, who expels them all, in 1972, they tried to migrate to Britain. Now, this is really remarkable because it's Britain's worst nightmare. They've already tried to scupper what they called coloured immigration. They're determined, even though the numbers are remarkably small. And the British tried to find all sorts of solutions. They tried diplomatic channels. They try all sorts of bizarre and quite disturbing things, including trying to find an island in the Indian Ocean where all their nationals of Indian descent can go. And finally, they think, okay, well, we're going to have to pass legislation to do this, and they do. What's so incredible is that they design the legislation so that the remaining white settlers in Kenya are allowed to go back unrestricted, but the British nationals of Indian descent are restricted. So really, these two pieces of legislation are the sort of culmination of this whole story. We're really late in the day now, in the sense of we're no longer in the initial post-war period. We're right into the period of decolonization. And these Indians have fallen through the crack of the border between empire and nation state. And there's so much to say on this, which obviously I won't go into, but these people who were described as the detritus of empire by one British policymaker, they find themselves at the sharp end of, you know, imperial citizenship. And there are all sorts of consequences to this. And the situation is much more severe in Uganda, where Idi Amin has expelled all Asians. He's quite vague about, you know, who he means, but it turns out he's particularly targeting British nationals in Uganda. And this leads to all sorts of things, but I suppose it's the sort of culmination of the story that I set out to tell at the beginning, which is to really say how on earth did this happen? What were the implications? And I suppose one thing I'd like to emphasize is that they tend to be a little bit better remembered now for reasons I can maybe talk about in a little while, but they've tended to go under the radar, these episodes, but they caused a sort of constitutional crisis at the time. They caused an international reputational crisis for Britain, and Britain ended up being ruled against in the European Court of Human Rights, which it was a sort of a body of the European Court of Human Rights, which were. And in the ruling, they're very, you know, the judgment is very explicit. These laws are racist. They're targeting people on the grounds of race, and they simultaneously favor white people. You know, white people is actually a verbatim quote. And you know, this is a sort of legal and political story, but it kind of comes to a head in the late 60s, and then there's a kind of aftermath after that.
Just for listeners, I really want to emphasize that we're skimming over the surface of so much rich content that's in the book, that you really need to pick up this book for yourselves and really get into sort of see sort of the masterful way that the book is written and the ways that sort of people's voices also come across in the telling of these different episodes. So, Ian, I can't not ask you about the connection to current events. So how does this book help us make sense of some of the things that are going on today?
Well, you know, I suppose that the most obvious relevance is for post-war Britain, for post-war, but also contemporary Britain. You know, it is also, the book is helpful, I think, for understanding, you know, Canadians and Australians and their background. It's also, it helps us make sense of the Indian and the South Asian diaspora. But really, what it really hopefully explains a lot about is contemporary Britain. And as I think I mentioned earlier, what is Britain? Is it a nation state? Is it a Commonwealth? If so, what is the Commonwealth? You know, if you sort of follow the public discourse, there's this sort of strange sense in which Britain doesn't want to turn away from its past, but actually there are all sorts of which seems quite, you know, reasonable on the face of it. But actually, if you look at a lot of the issues that are really that power British politics, like Brexit, for example, which was all about, you know, turning away from Europe and embracing what? Global Britain? What is global Britain? Immigration is obviously a huge issue. I mean, immigration in Britain today is distinct from the immigration that I talk about in the sense that it's much broader. It's not just immigration from former colonies. But I think that if you really want to get at the heart of the British self-image, there has been a reluctance at the very least to look at this history. And it really is remarkable how little of it is known. And, you know, you can think about, you know, there's a big piece of irony to this story, which is, you know, the current prime minister, Rishi Sunak, and also a former Home Secretary, Priti Patel. These are actually the children of families who were targeted by these laws. Rishi Sunak, his parents come from East Africa, from Kenya. They're Punjabi, if you go back far enough. But they came to the UK from Kenya, and they were actually completely implicated in this story. So think about that. Rishi Sunak's parents were targeted by an entire piece of legislation designed to keep them out on racial grounds. Priti Patel's family are coming from Uganda. There's another story there. So you think, okay, this is a perfect opportunity to sort of look back at this history. And it could have been done in all sorts of ways. You know, it doesn't have to be a kind of, the ways that the opportunities for making sense of it were just vast. You know, it doesn't have to be, you know, if there was a sense that, okay, we can't be seen to criticize the country or, you know, but there could have been an allusion to the history, and there wasn't. It was just this sort of remarkable opportunity lost. An opportunity lost is really the story of, you know, if you're growing up in Britain, whatever the decade may be, you'll find if you go to a sort of local school, you'll find yourself kind of in history classes, and there's a whole group of you who are connected to the empire, but that story tends not to be told. I mean, it was particularly the case for me. I imagine, you know, one would hope it's sort of changing now. So those are some of the contemporary relevances, I think. And, you know, I'll end on this. When Prince Charles had, King Charles had his coronation, I thought, what's going to happen with the Commonwealth? You know, this sort of the realms of the Commonwealth and this sort of history of imperialism, is Charles going to become head of the Commonwealth? Because it's not meant to be a hereditary post, you know. But Charles was declared to be head of the Commonwealth as if it were a hereditary post. And if we're being asked to believe that it is a hereditary post without the consent of, you know, without a sort of voting process, then what does that mean? And what does it sort of say about the identity of Britain?
And I think that's, you know, sort of what you were just saying is part of the reason why your book makes such an important intervention here. So readers who pick up your book will find, you know, this incredibly sophisticated and also beautifully written account, which begs the question, you know, were there any challenges that you faced while you were researching or writing the book?
Well, I think that writing a book is challenging in itself, but I think some of the methods were hard. So, for example, this is a legal story, but it's also much more than that. It's a political story. It's a human story. It's about experience and identity. So, the division of labor between law, politics, lived experience, that was, you know, testimony and other source materials, that was really hard to try to keep those in balance.
Okay, Ian, we've taken up more of your time than I initially intended, so I just want to ask you one final question, which is, what are you working on now?
I'm working on a new book, which I'm, you know, quite far along in the... So this conversation was a very welcome respite from getting on with that book. And it tells a somewhat complementary story, but it's really focused on South Asia. So it's, you know, quite a lot of this first book was about people of Indian and South Asian origin who are in the world. So I really wanted to sort of tell that story on a much bigger scale. And, you know, there's different ways it could go, and it's still very much in flux, but I'm really enjoying writing it.
That sounds incredibly interesting. I hope that you will come back to the show and talk to us about that book when it comes out. Ian, I really enjoyed our conversation today. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much, Lamise. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
The book is Ian Sanjay Patel's We're Here Because You Were There, Immigration and the End of Empire, published by Verso in 2021. Thank you for listening.